Into each economic life, a little wonkishness must fall. Today is your lucky day. Dynamic scoring is on the agenda. Also, junk bonds and a playwright's view of American capitalism. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In St. Paul today, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 5th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I know it often doesn't seem like it, very often of late, but there is a procedural method to the legislative madness in Washington, D.C. Case in point, a vote in the House today to pass a $1.4 trillion budget plan. Passage of said plan sets the table for a tax code overhaul down the road. Reconciliation is the legislative maneuver you're going to be hearing a whole lot about. But even though reconciliation will make it easier for the GOP to get taxes done, that doesn't mean it is going to be easy. There are a whole lot of big deal questions still up in the air. Chief among them, how to judge a tax plan, score it, figure out its potential effects on the economy. We asked Marketplace's Adrian Hill to explain something called dynamic scoring and why it has both sides in such a lather.
Dynamic scoring can cause policy pundits to freak. It's magical thinking, say critics. It involves assumptions that are too hard to make. And supporters say it's the only real way to know what a tax plan might do.
You know, both sides are obviously engaging in a little hyperbole.
Kent Smetters teaches at the Wharton School. Dynamic scoring is, at the end of the day, a tool. And like any tool, its value is in how and who is using it. Douglas Holtz-Eakin, former director of the Congressional Budget Office, says the way plans are traditionally scored,
it tries to take into account all sorts of reactions people might have to higher or lower taxes. But it typically does not change the size of the economy.
Dynamic scoring, on the other hand, adds in more of those indirect macroeconomic effects.
Saying, will the economy be larger or smaller as a result of this bill?
So what's the problem? Why not try to model total economic impact?
The argument against doing dynamic scoring is that it's hard.
Alan Auerbach teaches at UC Berkeley. He thinks dynamic scoring can be valuable, but because it's more difficult to model, it can also be more susceptible to politics and politicians putting their fingers on the scale. Maya McGinnis is head of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
The bottom line is that dynamic scoring makes sense as a concept, but we're not precise enough to treat it like a science. And so we should have it as another data point.
A data point that she says should come from a reputable, independent scorekeeper. Because we got to keep a level head here. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
This has been a difficult week for the President of the United States and the details of macroeconomic policy and practice. He said in Puerto Rico on Tuesday that federal spending on the recovery from Hurricane Maria has thrown the federal budget, quote, out of whack. In fact, so far, just over $2 billion has been allocated for Puerto Rico. That's against a multi-trillion dollar federal budget. Then Tuesday night, still in Puerto Rico, the president said the island's $72-ish billion in debt, most of which is already in default, is going to have to be, quote, wiped out. Not only did that send shudders through the bond market, but also presidents can't just order legitimate existing debt to be extinguished. Which gets us to this morning and the presidential Twitter feed, which at 7:09 this morning, Washington Times said this, quote, stock market hits an all-time high, unemployment lowest in 16 years, business and manufacturing enthusiasm at highest level in decades, end of quote, at exclamation points where you see fit. Couple of things about that. Number one, markets go down, too. Unemployment was at a 16-year low in June. It has gone up since then. And to be honest, it's not at all clear what numbers Trump was looking at about that whole business enthusiasm thing. But to grant him his bigger point, it's a long-established tradition for presidents to claim credit for the country's economic successes. Whether that credit is always deserved, far less clear. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that one.
Let's go back to 1932. President Herbert Hoover is running for re-election. The country's in the middle of a depression. Hoover's opponent, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, blames him for the economy and ultimately wins. Gil Troy is a presidential historian at McGill University.
And in the 1930s, as things get better, Roosevelt is able to take credit. So that's when we really start seeing the naming of an economic phenomenon with a president involved.
Troy says, sure, FDR's policies jump-started the economy, but so did other things, like World War II. War, oil prices, natural disasters, these can impact the economy in the short term. Lawrence J. White with NYU's Stern School of Business says a president's influence is more of a long slog.
Who the president appoints as the chair of the Federal Reserve, how much he pushes for particular kinds of legislation, that makes a difference.
White says policy changes take time. And Stephen Kyle, an economics professor at Cornell, says our $19 trillion economy doesn't respond immediately.
It's like trying to change the course of a giant oil tanker. You know, you can change it, but it's not going to turn on a dime. So I would say that the conditions for, you know, Trump's first year or any president's first year are largely determined before they even get there.
So why do presidents claim so much credit for the economy? That kind of talk wins elections. Ask FDR. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
You know how I keep saying markets go down too? They do, just not recently. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You want to find out what's going on in the actual economy as opposed to the headline statistics economy? I find it's helpful to talk to an actual practitioner in that economy. Lisa Goldenberg is the president of the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania. Lisa, it's good to have you back on.
Great to hear your voice.
Let me start with the question I always start with you, which is, how's business?
Business is good. We're moving along fairly solidly. I would say margins are getting kind of squeezed. I think that in the steel world, people are a little bit uncomfortable these days. No one's running out spending. It's kind of uncertain times.
Huh. Interesting. Well, so to that end, let's talk some policy things here that the White House is doing that it says and Congress says will help you in your business. I'm thinking specifically of tax reform. Where is an overhaul of the tax code on your list of things you want to see out of Washington?
I would love to see some tax reform. I think that when you and I spoke last time and maybe even the time before, if we're going to have this administration, and we have them, good or bad, doesn't matter, what can we hope to get out of an administration that might not be a first choice? Well, certainly what we spoke about last time, infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we haven't seen that yet, but I was very hopeful. And next on my list would be tax reform, but we'll see. I think we have a little bit of proposal burnout, great ideas, some high hopes, but not a lot of action.
Are you still hopeful? I mean, it's been a tough row to hoe here for the Republicans in Congress and the White House on their policy things.
Everything's been a tough road. It's a tough road to watch. But let's go for taxes. We couldn't get health care to be properly adjusted in a way that we could all live with, so we're going to abandon that. We couldn't get infrastructure in a way we could properly live with, so we'll abandon that. Let's try something else. Batter up.
If you have a lower tax bill, what are you going to do with the money? You're going to hire more people? You're going to invest? What are you going to do?
Well, let's be honest. Corporate taxes are pretty low anyway. Mm-hmm. They're talking about lowering corporate taxes, but fundamentally, corporate taxes are extraordinarily low.
You know, that's funny because that's not what you hear out of the White House and of Congress.
Right. Let's get real. Okay. Any business owner over a certain level will tell you essentially corporate tax is relatively low. If you're talking about pass-through companies and small business, I believe that if we could simplify, modify, help small business, I think it's the heart and soul of the American economy, and people will build inventories, buy equipment, hire more people, do the things they need to do to grow. And that's businesses on everyone's corner. That's the beauty salon. That's the garage. Mm-hmm. Most businesses are that, not big, what I've learned millennials call enterprise companies. Enterprise companies are the rest of the world. The rest of the world's not suffering on taxes.
So
the American people are suffering.
You're not thinking that you're going to see a great marginal gain there on your part for Delaware Steel?
For my business, for Delaware Steel, no. I would say in a more macro view, if you look at repatriating money and they come up with a way to bring that cash back, let me say this, that if we don't figure out a way to get that money back in this country, the European Union's going to figure it out because they've got it right now on the floor being debated. Someone's going to pay those taxes. And in my opinion, it should come back to the United States and we should figure out a way to get it back here without incentivizing people to open up in foreign countries. We have to sort of balance that out. And that money would really affect my business because that money will help balance our economy.
So we'll put you in the hopeful but skeptical it'll get done category, or are you hopeful it's going to get done?
Pieces of it will get done, but I am not hopeful that we will have resounding reform. How could we? We have yet to see anything meaningful get passed.
Lisa Goldenberg, the president of Delaware Steel. We'll talk to you soon.
Terrific. Thanks so much.
Coming up.
My dad made a deal with me when I first moved to New York in my early 20s. He said, if you read the Wall Street Journal every day, I'll pay your rent.
Tough love, right? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 113 points today, about a half percent, closed at 22,775. Did the blue chips. NASDAQ up 50 points, 0.7%, 65.85. The S&P 500 increased 14 points, about a half percent, 25.52. Costco beat sales expectations. One new offering from the wholesaler, food kits with a year's worth of emergency rations. Costco up 0.1%. Tech stocks gave the market a boost today. Google's parent Alphabet gained 0.9% today. Apple took a healthy bite, up 1.2%. Microsoft up about 1.7%. Bond prices, why they fell, thanks for asking. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.34%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The government of Puerto Rico has a website up helping to track the state of infrastructure recovery on the island. Status.pr is the address. Status.pr if you want to check it out. And here is just a sampling of the data 15 days, more than 2 weeks after Maria hit. 9% of the island has electricity. Just over a third of the ATMs are back in service, and about half of the territory has potable water. Getting the rest of the way back is going to take time, yes, but also a whole lot of heavy equipment operators and skilled workers. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson hitched a ride yesterday with a plane load of union nurses, truck drivers, and electricians headed from New York to Puerto Rico to help out.
We need all passengers to take your seats and fasten your seatbelt.
When we start the descent into San Juan, Luis Gonzalez looks out the window silently and wipes away a few tears.
My house is down there.
Gonzalez is Puerto Rican. He's from Bayamón, just 15 miles from the San Juan airport. He's lived in Brooklyn for 36 years now, but his mom and a bunch of family still live on the island. At first, from high in the air, the San Juan skyline looks normal. But as we descend further,
we got trees down, you see them? Only the palm trees are up.
So some buildings look fine, but some look a little battered and tattered.
Yeah, boy, got no electricity. Nobody could stay there.
Talking to his family, Gonzalez is frustrated that the aid seems to be arriving in Puerto Rico, but doesn't seem to be getting out to the people.
Why should I bring water from New York or food? I got food in my bag so I could bring to my mother. Why is she not getting food?
The federal government has over 10,000 workers on the ground in Puerto Rico, doing everything from installing generators and temporary roofing on hospitals to delivering diesel. But the need is vast.
We need all of the help that we can get here, you know, because all of the island is destroyed.
Jose Rodriguez Baez is president of the AFL-CIO in Puerto Rico.
The help, when you go to the community and you see the situation, it's too difficult for our people.
The mayor's office in San Juan gave the AFL-CIO a list of different skills they need and how many of each kind of worker they could use. Then the call went out to the union affiliates across the country for heavy equipment operators, drivers with heavy truck licenses, medics, electricians. The mayor's office will provide food and housing, and it'll assign the workers to jobs in San Juan and the surrounding areas. Luis Gonzalez gets off the plane and looks at all the people waiting to board flights off the island. He notes the number of elderly people in wheelchairs.
Everybody's leaving, old people. I mean, they got families in other states, Florida. They just leave.
The Center for Puerto Rican Studies at Hunter College in New York estimates the net outflow of people from Puerto Rico might double or triple this year, though those numbers could be tempered a bit by people returning to work on the recovery.
Hi, welcome aboard. How are you? You know where you're going?
The same United plane that brought those union workers down now loads about 250 evacuees to take off the island. The airline allowed government and relief agencies to give away free spots to people who needed to leave. Lily Belize and her three-year-old daughter scored seats in first class. She chokes up when the flight attendant brings out dinner.
Is the first thing hot?
She says over the last couple weeks, finding milk for her daughter has been a daily struggle, and she's been eating
bread, chef boyardee, salchichas, sausage, cookies, cornflakes.
She's alone with her daughter and desperate to get to family in Orlando, but two previous flights off the island were canceled. She only found out she could get on this United flight about 6 hours before it left.
This is very hard. And you don't have time to say goodbye to no one. You have to go. Now. Have to go.
She thinks she'll be gone maybe 5-6 months, but she's not really sure. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
When I was in New York last week, I went over to Lincoln Center to talk about high-yield debt. Seriously, high-yield debt, leveraged buyouts, and the era, the 1980s, in which that kind of high finance became common currency on Wall Street. Junk, a play that's in theory about all of that, but is in reality the story of capitalism in America today, opens in previews at the Lincoln Center Theater tonight. So on Tuesday morning last week, I sat down for a chat with a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, Ayad Akhtar.
What are you doing right now, by the way? Are you like supervising rehearsals up there? Are they doing? What
well,
are you doing?
Supervising is a big word. I mean, I'm participating. I there's still changes to be made. You know, little tweaks here, or there. You know, nips and tucks. And actually, I rewrote an entire scene yesterday. So
I was going to say. So the draft of the script I read was dated September the 10th.
Yes.
This airs on the 5th of October.
Yeah.
When your preview night.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, you're not done.
No.
How come, man?
Because you have a group of actors who can make you see where the potholes are, even if they're small. You know, the big challenge with a play like this is that not everyone's going to understand the, you know, intricacies of high yield or leverage buyouts or whatever it may be. And so, you know, they don't need to understand that. It's about making the human actions and the human metaphors underneath all of that stuff very clear.
Let's back up for a minute and have you tell me how... I mean, you've written a lot of things about Muslim Americans and Pakistani Americans and diversity in this country, and,
sure.
and we're going to get to all that. How do you come to finance?
My dad made a deal with me when I first moved to New York in my early 20s. He said, if you read the Wall Street Journal every day, I'll pay your rent.
Really?
Yeah. So
you did it. And there it is. That's the actual paper.
I still get the journal every day. He wanted to get me interested in the real world, if you will. You know, he and my mom said, oh, this kid is reading too much poetry. What are we going to do about it?
Do your parents know you imitate them like that? They're going to find out here real soon.
They probably do. And I have always had an interest in how finance shapes our way of being and thinking, because I think it increasingly does.
Interesting to hear you say that, because this play... I'm not going to give anything away here, but A, it's depressing as hell, and
it's a lot of fun,
and B, it really does point one to the fact that money and wealth and the accumulation of it are the fundamental American experience.
Yes, that's right. I do believe that. I do believe that the accumulation of wealth is the expression of personal will par excellence in American life.
Did you call guys you know on Wall Street and say, hey, fact check this for me?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, actually, one of my best friends is a pretty high-powered businessman, and he reads everything. He comes to First Preview, gave me notes. You know, most notably, I had had one line where I was making a contention about the Fed and how they had changed their policy in 79 with Volcker sort of initiating
get
this.
Get a load of you. Listen to this. This is great.
But this is, yeah, sure. But I mean, October 79 is in some ways the most important date, I think, in American economic history. You know, because when Volcker decided to allow interest rates to rise to take care of inflation, it changed the entire environment. It's what created the possibility for high yield. It's what created the appetite for leverage for debt. I mean, none of that may have happened if interest rates weren't floating around 20% and people got the sense that you could just put your money in a bank account and you could make 20%. Well, where else can I do that? And, you know, from that point forward, fixed income departments at major banks became the most lucrative way to make money. It still is the case. But anyway, Steve and I got into a whole thing of arcana about what it actually happened and how the Fed was really changing policy. And he just gave me so much grief that I ended up cutting the line because
it's too bad because that little riff right there was really, really good. Disgraced, the play for which you won the Pulitzer. Was about diversity and the immigrant experience and the minority experience in this country.
It was about a Wall Street lawyer who is not ultimately able to fulfill the promise of the American dream,
which is in many ways the immigrant experience in this country.
Totally.
That's sort of what it's about.
Good point.
You aggressively seek out the expression of diversity in your work. I mean, here you are, a Pakistani American guy born in Staten Island, raised in where? Michigan, right?
No, Wisconsin.
Wisconsin club, whatever.
We have a problem with that.
I'll get some letters
Wisconsin.
About that.
Yeah. If you, yes. I mean, I'm not sure that I aggressively seek it out. I think I just reflect that it's my experience, and I reflect that it's the experience. You know, in this play, there's a African American lawyer, African American law enforcement agent. There's a a Hispanic lawyer for working for the Bob Merkin, the junk bond king. And, there are a few Jewish characters in this play. Wall Street has often been a very ethnic place in a way, sort of reflecting the kind of, polyglot and sometimes not entirely melted pot of America.
There's a in the draft script that I read, there's in the sort of preamble, the thing where you, talk about how you wanted to look, physically look on stage. You talk about the sets and how you don't want set designers to aggressively try to replicate the era. You want it to be a little bit
looser.
You don't use this word, but fuzzy, right? You don't want to be the origin myth.
Here. Right. Well, I think that it would be easy to come to this play and see characters in like outrageous 80s outfits with, 80s music pumping in. And you could say, oh, wow, that funny era. Look at what those people were like then. But the fact is that all those practices, which were so shocking and appalling to people at that time, have become de rigueur. In a way, the backward glance of taking a look at this era of the 80s through the filter of some of these mythic events that took place is a way to sort of try to look at our era now.
Well, let's talk about that era now, right? Because you had the 80s, you had the financial crisis, which was almost 10 years ago now. And we have in this economy, in this society, inequality increasing at a rate we haven't seen in generations. And here you write about this stuff in a very not hopeful way.
Well, I don't think we're in a hopeful place. I think that it would be a disservice to people to offer yet another rosy picture of the benefits of globalization or financization or whatever ancillary free market ideology or tenets that have been promulgated over the last 50 years that have now become catechism in our society. I don't know that adherence to those beliefs is in our best interest. And I'm not speaking as a bleeding heart liberal. I'm speaking as somebody who I think understands this stuff and understands, love him or hate him, there's a lot of things to hate about Henry Ford. But one of the things that he said, which I think is a key observation, is that if you can't pay your workers enough to buy the cars they make, you're going to have a long-term structural problem. And that's everybody's problem. That's not just blue states' problems or red states' problems. That's everybody's problem. If the humble thing an artist can do, is to tell a story that maybe makes people reflect on the situation, which is all I'm really trying to do, and move them and entertain them at the same time. Give them lots of laughs before I depress them.
Well, all right. Well, Eric, I read, the version I read had a couple of laughs. I don't know. We'll see. I don't know. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
I had Akhtar a week or so ago. His play Junk starts previews tonight at the Lincoln Center Theater in New York. This final note on the way out today, Netflix and chill, or Netflix and, you know, pretty much anything, is going to be getting more expensive. The company announced price hikes today across the board. It's a couple of bucks for the premium service, $13.99 a month. Here is at least one reason why. I heard the company's chief content officer, Ted Sarandos, say at a conference this week that his content budget next year is going to be $7 billion. Dollars. I guess they're going to get it $2 at a time from us. Wall Street being what it is, Netflix shares hit an all-time high today. And that is all we got. The Dow up 113 points today, about a half percent, 22,775. NASDAQ gained 57 tenths percent, 6,585. S&P 500 up 14 points, about a half percent, a neatly palindromic 2,552. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Daniel Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor, emphasis on the interim, is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.